Hi, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the podcast that asks one big question in many ways. How can awakening and consciousness help human beings rise to meet our current challenges, to make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet? I've conducted over 100 remarkable conversations exploring this subject with many of today's leading thought leaders, scientists, and spiritual teachers. Once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for download. Today, I'm excited to be joined by Michael Mead, the great storyteller. We're going to continue that discussion in a conversation entitled, "The World is in Trouble and It Needs Your Genius." I'll introduce Michael and we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements, and then we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions, so we'll finish up in about 90 minutes. Michael Mead is a renowned storyteller, author, and scholar of mythology, anthropology, and psychology. He first came to my attention many years ago as one of the founding figures of the men's movement, along with Robert Bly, Sam Keane, and Bill Kauf's Mankind Project. He co-edited with Bly and the great Jungian psychotherapist and writer James Hillman a best-selling anthology of the poetry of passage called The Rag and Bone Shop of the Heart. He is the author of Fate and Destiny, The Two Agreements of the Soul, Why the World Doesn't End, and his latest book, The Genius Myth. He's the founder of Mosaic Multicultural Foundation, a nonprofit network of artists, activists, and community builders that encourages greater understanding between diverse peoples. Currently, he's working with at-risk youth and tells moving stories of those encounters, illuminating the pages of The Genius Myth, his latest book. Something I especially appreciate about Michael is his grounded masculine ability to communicate with soul-level authority and humility. I'm often deeply affected by his capacity to speak the truth and tell stories in ways that awaken insight, touch my soul, and move my heart. Some of his stories are able to humble the pride of my thinking mind, transmitting the broken open disposition in which wisdom becomes possible. I invited him to have this public conversation because he has been working for years with many of the big questions I ask here. For example, Michael wrote in The Genius Myth, "The answers to the overwhelming problems and daunting global issues we all face cannot simply come from the limited consciousness of abstract reasoning and scientific attitudes that currently dominate the world. The problems run deeper than the simple facts of the matter. The answers must be found in deeper places as well. The loss of a felt connection to the divine spark hidden within each person may be the greatest curse of modern mass societies. When the dark times come round and great changes are afoot, it becomes more important that awake people remain awake, and that more individuals awaken to the nature of the spark of life they carry within. In the great drama of life, the human soul becomes the extra quantity and distinct living quality needed to tip the balance of the world toward creation." I'm really excited to be able to engage this public conversation with you, Michael. Welcome to Beyond Awakening.
Thank you. Good to talk with you, Terry.
Well, there are so many things we can get into. I would like to invite you maybe to begin by grounding this in some of what you shared in The Genius Myth. In that book, you vividly tell stories about your work with some of the most at-risk kids in the country, young men and women who have the least and some who have the most. And I was particularly touched by your description of some of the most privileged youth who became self-destructive and whose lives began to go down the tubes, partly because their privilege had damaged them and cut them off from their souls, making them perhaps the hardest of the youth to reach. And I'm wondering if the a lesser intensity, perhaps, but a much more pervasive version of those soul wounds might pertain in many of those of us who've accepted the many little bribes from which our middle-class American lives are woven and which keep us kind of selling out for comfort and convenience.
Well, one of the ideas I worked with in the book was an old statement that genius is revealed in adversity and concealed in comfort. So the genius, I start with the idea that genius, the original meaning of it, is the spirit that's already there, so that each soul, each person who comes into the world comes in with a unique genius. That's the first key idea, really, is that each person, not that each person is a genius, but each person brings a genius to the world. That was the original idea behind the word. And so, in a sense, the purpose of individual life is the arc of transformation that reveals this hidden core of genius. And the genius then is defined as a kind of a mixture of gifts and talents, capacities, aims and purposes, and a very unique style. And so I'm putting two things into the book, in a sense. The first is the idea of the old Greek idea of apocalypsis, that there are certain times when the world itself is going through a radical transformation. And the old Greek word for that was apocalypsis. And one side of it is collapse, and the other side is renewal. And so the collapse side, to me, is now intensely manifest in this ongoing series of tragedies and disasters. I think since the last time you and I spoke, I don't even know if I can name everything, but if we start just within the last month, you go from Orlando to Istanbul Airport to Dakar to intensification of destruction in Iraq to Baton Rouge to St. Paul to Dallas, then to Nice, back to Turkey, and then this morning back to Baton Rouge, where more police officers have been shot down. And so that's the background for all young people growing up, is a world that is, in a sense, on fire with conflict and increasingly with mania, intensifications of fears and anxieties. And so whether a person is born into the middle class or the upper class or born into the lower classes, they're all being born into a world that is, in a sense, unraveling on the cultural side, but surprisingly, at the same time, rattling on the side of nature. So we're living through a very unusual time where the storms of nature increase and the storms of culture intensify. And so what I intended with the book was, as you were quoting, there is no one answer. There's no simple solution. All of the politics is polarized, you know, in this country, in Turkey, even though they just avoided the coup, the president has 49.5% support. So polarization, conflict, more people being pushed to the margins. And strangely enough, you can be in the margins if you're wealthy or if you're poor, because the margin is now in an intensification of psychic disturbance. And so what I wanted to try and say before this summer started, the book came out about a month ago, was that when the world is rattling and the institutions cannot be depended upon, and even when nature has been filled with disturbance, then there has to be a place to turn to. And I'm suggesting we turn to what in the old sense was the deep seed of genius in each soul, and then the idea that each person has something meaningful to contribute to the world, especially if they can awaken, as you're saying, the consciousness that's tied to their own unique genius. We need everybody's genius to help solve these, you know, intense mass problems of climate change and cultural disaster.
I'm sobered and asking myself if, in a way, we are up against a moment in which the whole way we've been living is being revealed to have been, you know, so unsustainable from the beginning that we're all collectively being given a kind of an intervention, the way an addict's friends can come to him and say, look, buddy, you're out of control. You need to change your life. You need to turn it around. To some degree, the way in which some of the most wounded among us are going crazy and lashing out in ways that are so horrific that they demand the society pay attention is an expression of that psychically, and the way the nature and the other creatures and the imbalances of the natural world are going wacky. It's as if on all sides we're being told that we need to go through a process of reckoning and turning our lives around, and that this is something that each of us has to take very personally, even though obviously the answers can't all come from any one of us. It's only by each of us letting this intervention actually bring us to our knees that we become vulnerable enough to participate in the kind of turnaround that seems to be being asked for.
Yeah, that's well said. In the book, I call it a time of collective initiation, in the sense that we are being initiation being an old word that means to awaken to what's present and step further into it. And so, one way to understand it, outside of all the political historical stuff, is a call to awaken, to be conscious, and then I'm just giving it this twist. Because the issues are so big, which is part of what's causing all the stalemating, people can't even imagine, a lot of people deny climate change because they can't imagine it. And so the issues are so big that it needs many, many responses, and I wanted to make a distinction between the hero's journey or the hero's myth, which tends to have a masculine tone and tends to imply achievement in the outside world and the winning of something, to the genius myth, which says that the answer we're looking for is hidden inside us, closer to Eastern philosophy perhaps, but it also exists in the Western world under the old idea of genius, and that what we're really being asked to do is find that inside ourselves, which is the essence of ourselves, but it also, which involves the gift that we came to the world to give, in a sense. And we're going back to the book. So I wrote these two books trying to address the two big issues. I'm basically a mythologist. I've been studying myths since I was 13. And so on a mythic level, there's always two stories: the condition of the world and the response of the individual soul in the world. And in Why the World Doesn't End, I tell the old Mayan creation story, in which the people become very hard-headed and hard-minded, and they begin to invent things that are also hard, like what we would call now machinery and certain kinds of technology. And then the animals and nature begin to turn against people because they use their inventiveness to make things that were not attuned to the local environment or to nature in general. And so then, this is an old story, and there's more than one creator god, and the gods agreed to wipe out that experiment of humans that turned into human types that turned into a hard thing, and then create another type of humans who are born from corn, which is a sacred kind of essence close to the nourishing capacity of nature. And the corn people then become the ones who have gratitude for the gift of life and a consciousness about the wonder of creation and a capacity to help creation keep going. And so, you know, that's the mythic way of talking about what's going on. We're in an extended point now where we can either be swallowed by the collapsing of things, or we can find the thread of our own life that allows us to become agents of ongoing creation. Apocalypsis means kind of disorder and renewal. And so we're at a point where, yes, some things are falling apart, and that's going to continue in tragic ways. Nothing anyone can do can simply stop that. But there are things that we could do to assist the making of the next world, if you want to call it that mythologically, or a better human community in terms of sociology.
You know, I've often found myself making a distinction in my own heart between two kinds of approach to this idea of soul work or genius, one of which feels more real to me than the other. One feels kind of ersatz. There's a kind of self-importance and narcissism that people can get into in focusing on my uniqueness, my genius, my gift. But there's a deeper work in which we awaken from our ego attachment and self-importance and narcissism and face the terror of our insignificance and discover that on our knees, suddenly, now, we actually have a different ground. And there, much more humbly, we do have a gift to bring and a talent, and that talent is a responsibility. And I feel always called to the truer version of this and by your writings. This is one of the things I really appreciate and why I wanted to have this conversation. And I wonder if there's a particular story that you can tell that will help illustrate that passage into the humility that makes this contact with one's genius authentic and deep.
Yeah, that's a good. The first thing that comes to mind is a battle veteran. For years, I've worked with veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and consciously bringing them together in remote places, which is the best way to do that kind of work, with Vietnam-era veterans, with the idea that the old veterans could become mentors to the newer veterans, which, by the way, works very well. And let's see, just maybe a backup idea. The ideas that I've gathered about genius and human uniqueness and the capacity to create in the midst of turmoil have come from working with, you know, people in the margins. So I've been for over three decades trying to test ideas, what helps when people are in their darkest moments. And so what first came to my mind was the story of a Vietnam veteran who came to one of these events and had been dealing with PTSD for what, over 40 years, almost 50 years. And in the middle of the intensity of having younger veterans reveal the deepest story they're carrying, he was provoked to tell a story that he had never told before, that he had, first of all, volunteered for Vietnam as a 17-year-old, lied about his age, wound up in the middle of many battles, and at one point had a horrifying experience where he was ordered to collect the kind of shattered body parts of, in order to clear a certain area where bodies had been shattered and strewn. And he at first refused to do it because the enemy's body parts were mixed with his you know, fellow soldiers, and he wouldn't touch them, and he was ordered to do it, so he wound up doing it. And so he was telling this for the first time, even though it was 40-some-odd years later, because it was so hard to put into words. And in the process, he explained that from that day on, he has never smelled anything that was put before him. And so he got through the telling of it, and And then we had to create like a ceremony to cleanse him of this kind of horror that was even taking away his senses, in a sense. And finally, after being supported by the other everyone there and submitting to a ceremony of cleansing and so on, I asked him, you know, what did that 17-year-old want from the world or want in life? And he didn't hesitate a bit. He went right to it. He said, when I was that age, I wanted to be a singer. I wanted to write songs and sing them. And so I said, well, have you ever pursued that? And he said, well, quietly, I do. He said, but I don't think I'm very good. And so someone had a guitar, and we convinced him to play the guitar and sing one of his songs. And it was a real struggle to find that voice that was down underneath all of that horror that he experienced. But slowly the voice came through, and you realize he was, in fact, a gifted singer, a little bit like a Johnny Cash voice. And from there he went, a lot of troubles along the way, but went into seriously following that gift and writing songs. And now he travels around the country singing soldiers' blues. He writes blues about what happens in battle and what happens in war and what happens to the soldiers after the war. And he travels around singing that as a way of continuing his own healing and bringing a sense of healing to the aftermath of modern wars. That's the story that came to mind when you asked me the question.
Mm. Yeah, it's a beautiful story. That's one of the things I really treasure, is that it seems you've, you know, at the end of your book, you talk about the soul being at the center, at the heart of the being, but that the broken pieces, as we try to reweave what's been broken, are things we find at the margins. And it seems like your dedication to working with people who are at risk, particularly young people, is an expression, you know, to bring the strength of whatever you've come to understand and whatever wisdom you have to put that at service of people who are really fighting the life and death battles of the soul, where we're ready to despair, we're ready to turn to violence, we're ready to go crazy, and to weave the periphery back into the center. I found that very moving, and I also found moving the metaphor that you use, because when we're losing touch with it, it's like we go into a fog, and you named these fogs, the red fog, the white fog, the black fog, and those qualities of fog are operative when people are really, really brought to their knees, when life is you know, when they're maybe not going to make it, maybe are, and you're trying to work in that place. But there's a pervasive fog that anesthetizes us all, and I know we're, you know, I both want to hear the stories of the work you've done in these more dramatic places where you're really in touch with the visceral qualities of it, but I do want to loop that back to the general experience of many of the people who will hear this conversation that we're having, who are maybe struggling with a tendency to succumb, maybe not even struggling sometimes, but succumbing to a kind of fog of anesthetization that our middle-class lifestyles tend to draw us toward.
So a long time ago I was asked actually to work with young people in urban inner-city situations, particularly gangs. So you have to answer the call, I think, when you're called. And since I had some background with that, I began working in Chicago and South Central LA and all over the place, and realized that when you're in certain neighborhoods and you're in certain groups, you're inside the red fog. The red fog of war is one version of it, and the red fog of street gangs is another version of it. And it's very clear. You can smell it. You can learn to identify it, and you can see that it's a fog of kind of violence, that it things result in violence, and people are way on edge and over inflamed. And then, you know, I began to look at what's happening in primarily suburban white culture and in middle class culture. And you can see there a kind of white fog. And that's the fog of kind of distancing or self-distancing even, where a person becomes numb, where a person is a little bit blanked out and maybe just living a routine and substituting the idea of a little bit of comfort for being alive. And then if you're working with youth in those circumstances, you see a tremendous distance between the sense of self in the red fog areas. People will get in your face. People will say, hey, man, what are you up to? You telling the truth or not? And there's a certain kind of clarity about that, even if it's a little intense. But when I've gone into suburban schools and that kind of thing, what you're dealing with is actually a distance from that intensity. And so you can start to look at this comparison of a white fog of distancing, which now has added to it the kind of miasma caused by personal devices and technology, and people disappear into their own worlds and can't really get going fully in life. And so I started to experience a lot of that in going to suburban communities. And then just to finish the metaphor, the black fog becomes when either of those go into despair. And so in the past number of years, I've increasingly been involved with suicide in middle class, upper middle class, and wealthy communities and families, where a certain kind of despair has grown, and there's been an increase of youth suicide in particular. And when I've worked with those who are suicidal and the friends of those who have committed suicide, if I ask them, what's inside you, in whether it's direct or indirect, what they wind up saying is, I think there's nothing inside me. And that's where the white fog turns into a dark despair, when someone feels empty inside. And so that's one of the places where I just began instinctively say, wait a minute, what about the genius you're born with? And I've had numerous young people go, what are you talking about? Everyone's born with the seed of genius in their soul. That's what makes you you and anybody else themselves. And that genius knows what you're here to do, and it has gifts to give. And I've had young people just go, I didn't know that. No one told me, and make a real change in self-awareness just from that awakening to that idea. Not that it solves everything, but just to say that, you remember trickle-down economics,
mm-hmm.
where the money never trickled down.
Right.
Well, there was also a thing that I call trickle-down tabula rasa, the old idea of the blank slate, that the human soul is blank and only affected by the outside experiences of family and community and so on. Well, that idea of tabula rasa or blank slate has trickled down. I find it in educated areas where people are more educated and have more opportunity, and I find it down, believe it or not, in the gangs and in the streets where people have less opportunity and are oppressed. Both of those communities have often landed on the idea that we're empty inside, which is, of course, going to be the source of despair and not just deep uncertainty, but actually a kind of self-rejection. And so then lately, the surprising thing that we have found working in the more oppressed communities is an increase of youth suicide amongst those who have very little, along with an increase amongst those who have a lot. So there's a kind of despair right under the busy skin of American, you know, modern American life. There is a despair that cuts across social differences.
Yeah. And that fog is something that maybe is not you know, it's maybe most acute at when people are vulnerable, when they're young, when they're in that moment of trying to decide who they're going to be, trying to create their persona, try to know who they are, create their lives, choose their careers and all that. But in some sense, every one of us in this society is tending to go into a fog to a certain amount, degree. Even when we, you know, watch the news and feel care about what's happening on the broad scale, so much of it overwhelms us and numbs us. It's as if there are a variety of different kinds of fog that are tending to capture us, a kind of fog of overcare for things we can't touch, a fog of self-hatred because we are doing nothing and we're somehow part of the problem, a fog of confusion. And I find myself wanting to hear the stories that you would want to tell to those of us who've been maybe connoisseurs. We've used our wealth to develop our souls, our interiority, to know ourselves psychologically, to read widely, to feast on great poetry. We've come to certain levels of depth, but also we know that we're living inside a system that's devouring the planet, and we're trying to square the circle, trying to come into integrity, and knowing that we're not fully, and the way that we're fogged out is an issue. And somehow there's a soul level conversation among us that's asking to be had.
Well put. So I went back to an old Irish kind of folk myth that says when the center falls apart, it doesn't disappear. In other words, anything that is an essential part of creation can't disappear. It can move, it can shift, it can reform somewhere. And the center, which would be holding everything together, when it falls apart, the pieces of it go to the margins. So the idea is, in a time like this, when the center cannot hold, whether it's politically, economically, culturally, religiously, whatever way you want to talk about it, most of the institutions have very little holding power anymore, then what was part of that holding is now found at the edges or in the margins. And so then in the Irish story, they say, go to the margin that attracts you and makes you afraid. And there, find a thread and then pull that thread back to the center. And if enough people do that, then the center is rewoven of not of big heroic movements, but of individuals pulling the thread of their own existence and their own consciousness and their own capacity to create things back to the center. And so the movement there, to me, is very clear. That is to say, the vitality that's missing in the center, the creativity, whether this is the soul of the individual or the soul of the culture, when it's missing is in the margins. And so it's a kind of almost paradoxical, but if a person wants to have meaningful challenge and vitality, the place to find it is in the edge, on the margin. That's where things change in nature, and that's where the elements of change are hidden in culture, too. And so when I'm saying each person has a genius, I'm also implying that that genius would want to do meaningful work, and that being educated is not enough. As a matter of fact, the word education comes from educare, the Latin verb, which means to lead it out. And so a real education is when the genius of the person is led out into the world, where it can be seen as a factor of ongoing creation. And so in a way, we have to challenge ourselves to go to that edge or that margin or that place of uncertainty, which is the kind, which provides the kind of adversity that will allow us to fully awaken. And that's the in the terms I'm using, that's the solution for the individual's self-loathing or self-rejection, and it's also the solution for the renewal of community. And so that we're living in a time when the impetus for that is provided from outside ourselves. It's provided by the disturbances in culture, in nature, because some people are born with the gift. I was born in New York City, and my idea of nature was Central Park, which is a great place. But I've since then been many places, and I've met people who intuitively understand the relationship between, you know, the forest and the trees, and people who understand how water works and how you could purify water or cleanse the course of water. And then there are other people who have an instinct for hospice work. They know how to be with someone who's dying. And that's what I mean by genius, that those qualities are there from the beginning. And if a person follows that kind of path, the genius path, then the old rule would say they not only find a way of self-satisfaction, but they find a way of contributing something beneficial to the life of others. And so that's what I've found working in very difficult circumstances is when, so genius is inside and waiting to awaken and express itself, but often there has to be a shattering of the ego attitudes, and like you were talking about, a humbling of, and the humbling is the humbling of one's ego, and the ego isn't just, you know, Donald Trump style megalomania. That's only one style of ego. The other trap of ego is the person who builds a little life and makes it safe. And their restricting ego attitudes are also kind of strangling the expressive nature of their own genius. And so ego just means whatever fixed attitudes we aggregated in order to protect ourselves from both self-loathing and the idea that we might be annihilated by risking ourselves in the world. And that ego has to be shattered. That's the breaking of the spell of narcissism. And underneath that is waiting that part of us that, like the Vietnam veteran, wants to sing and write songs and bring healing to the world. And whatever it is in the individual soul, that's waiting to be found. But the ego, pretending to be in charge of one's life, has to be shattered. And you know, cultures used to help people with that by having rites of passage, and now your kind of rites of passage have to be fashioned from the troubles of your own life.
Yeah. So if I'm just trying to imagine, you know, there are many different people in different situations and different moments in their lives listening to us right now, but many of them may be people who've turned to the inner work, who've come to see the challenges at a soul level, but who, like many of us in this society, have made their lives pretty comfortable, and who are doing the inner work and working on maybe they even do some service, but they're getting the message from the way the world is falling apart that whatever it is we're doing now, however good it may be, because most of us are good people who do reach out and offer help and serve and make contributions to the lives of other people, but somehow this cascade of calamity is calling out to us like an intervention and asking us to make a new level of change. And for us to internalize that in a way that brings coherence to the world and doesn't cause us to only be shaken and confused and frightened and to respond from the places that are still kind of quivering, you know, in us. What are the words of guidance that you'd offer to those listening to your voice right now who are trying to hear this in the deepest and most transformational way, possible?
Well, the first image that comes to my mind is the Bodhisattva image. And so, you know, classic Hindu spirituality, you know, you have self-enlightenment and self-salvation is one of the paths, but it usually was called the lesser path. And the greater path was called the path of return, where a person goes through whatever spiritual practices they are called to and awakens in whatever ways they are able to, and then reaches a point where they realize that whatever I may have achieved in terms of personal awakening or increase of consciousness, I have to bring back to the world and have to find ways to offer it to others who have not been able to see the light hidden in darkness or be able to see the burning spark of the divine inside themselves. So the Bodhisattva move to me is, and it always was, you know, in the history of spirituality and mysticism, I think it's the key move. Whatever I learn, I have to share and bring back. And so at the end of Fate and Destiny, I was trying to figure out how do you end a book on destiny, and I wound up going for the idea that we are living in a time now where it is, in a sense, inappropriate to just seek a personal form of enlightenment or salvation, that we are actually collectively called to bring whatever shards and shreds of learning, whatever pieces of knowledge, whatever lights of consciousness we may have contacted and been able to handle, to bring them back to the benefit of the world being both nature and culture. And now I'm tying that to the deepest ideas of mysticism, which says, in a sense, that the divine is hidden inside the darkness of a person, and the divine is hidden inside this world. That job of humans is to really bring heaven to earth, not to leave earth for heaven. But humans are a conduit. We're in a sense, our imaginations are reach up into the stars, and our feet are tied or connected to the deepest energy of the earth, and we are a transmitter, in a sense, a channel between those two great vertical forces. And right now, when the world has become flat through, you know, technology, in the sense that the World Wide Web is horizontal, it lacks verticality. And so humans that are awakening, and awakening to me would always imply a kind of intuition of the heights, but also an empathy for the depths. When a person should feel some of that, then this is the time to find a way to bring it back to the world, because what we're lacking is vertical imagination, which, or vertical spirituality, or vertical emotional presence, which is necessary to bring the horizontal qualities into a genuine community. And so not to say I'm going to save the world, but to say what little I may have learned, I owe it to the world. I owe it. I mean, it's interesting, you know, if you go to work where people are in despair and where people are in life and death circumstances, not only is it humbling, but it also starts to kind of call upon something deep inside oneself, where no matter what my limited experience may be, or no matter the depth of my own fears, there is something that wants to be counted on the side of life over death, counted in the process of enhancing life, as opposed to either actively or by not acting, contributing to the collapse and the destruction. Because, you know, not to get into the intricacies of philosophical thought and so on, but not acting is an act. And yeah. So when a person decides to not act in a way that they would be capable of, they are, in a sense, withholding what I call their genius. You could call it their gold. You could call it their life energy. They're withholding that from the world. And I think we, long time ago, passed the point where that could be justified.
You know, I work with a lot of people who feel that kind of call and who are interested in actualizing their purpose, who have that, have heard the message you just articulated. And often I find that the next thing that's necessary is, because we can then want to charge forward and show everybody what we have understood, and we want to communicate our clarities. But often we don't see the person that we're turning toward. And while we're bursting forth with the sense of the wisdom and the learning that has been important for us, we're not really useful until our stride has been broken and we're dropped into contact with the ways in which we don't know anything and we're no better than anybody and nobody needs to listen to us, and we become listeners to others, and only after we've really listened and received them have we gained the common ground where what we have gained suddenly maybe just shows itself in a new facet, a new dimension, and we're able to give our gifts. But it's usually not by sinking, you know, entering into everything so clear that we have a great gift to give.
Yeah, so another aspect of apocalypse is an increasing revelation of paradox. So these are paradoxical times. You know, the coup in Turkey temporarily, let's say, has been, you know, defeated. And so then, on one hand, democracy rules because the democratically elected president is you know, retains office and retains the power. The problem then becomes that the democratically elected president is basically trying to bring more of an Islamic state to Turkey. This is the old inner opposition inside Turkey. And the military that would normally you'd say, oh, we don't want the military in charge, but they actually have a tradition that goes back to Kemal Ataturk, who's the military leader who pulled Turkey away from having a religious state. And so they're back in their own battle, which is kind of a paradox. And so what's winning and what's losing and so on like that. And so paradoxes are a big part of when the veil lifts, the world is revealed to be a greater paradox. And so is the individual. So the first mistake is that a person doesn't risk themselves in life, and then the second kind of mistake is that a person fully risks themselves. What I'm trying to say is we have no choice, I don't think, really, except to overdo our attempt at contributing and then, like you say, be humbled by the limits that suddenly appear. And maybe one way to think about it is that a person has to risk being egotistical and overblown enough to get knocked down to the deeper self that has a graciousness and a greater knowledge of when to push forward and when to pull back. But if a person doesn't really try, I remember one time doing a retreat with over 100 Buddhist meditation teachers. I mean, they were retreating. I came in to give a presentation. And one of them said, well, maybe you could help me with something because I feel like after I give a Dharma talk in my community, instead of simply, you know, returning to my humble self and walking off the dais, I want to hear from everybody how well I did and so on. And I feel like this is probably an obstacle in my spiritual path. And I couldn't help myself. I said, well, I think the problem here is not that your ego's in your way, but that your ego is too small. And he said, what? And I said, well, if just a few people are saying you gave a good talk and you find that an ego problem, I would say you haven't gone far enough. If you could give some talks and have feelings and create circumstances so that people in three counties beyond where you live are all upset with you, now you might have an ego that is evident And if you could meditate that ego away, if you could shatter it and remove it, then that would be an impressive spiritual arc. If you have a small ego and you manage to keep it in check, kind of, that's not very impressive. It's not very transformative. And it really doesn't lead to the revelation of what's waiting to be found. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's where I wound up. We all have the ego issue. We all have the abandonment issue. And we all have the deep self trying to find its way through those. And I think it's better to risk making some big foolish mistake. Hopefully that doesn't harm people, but that does reveal what's hidden and trying to become known. Mm-hmm. I find people playing it safe with spiritual ideas sometimes, just the way people can play it safe with economic ideas. And I think risking oneself fully in life has a real value. And that risk, you know, sometimes great risk is the only form of safety. And it's the only way to find out what's hidden behind that impulse. The impulse, you know, the ego, in a sense, is a double agent. It's the production of the deep self that creates it. And it's also the part of us that tries to obscure the deep self. And so the way I look at it mythologically is each of us is just a tiny speck in an eternal universe. And yet when a person is in touch with their true self or their genius and they are manifesting it, they are at the moment of creation. And so there's a second revelation. If the first one is the inappropriateness and misdirection and confusion of the ego, then the second one is the accuracy and the arc of creation of the deep self. And that's our paradox. And I think we have to kind of enter the one fully enough to line ourselves up with the other.
So you're, in a sense, like if I am particularly heartbroken to see a certain aspect of the shattering of the social fabric, of the qualities of connectedness among us all, of the of civility in our public life, of the center being able to hold, and I feel activated. I feel like I need to respond to that. You're suggesting, even if I don't know how to do it well, go out there and care about making a mess of it, but don't let my ego of wanting to not screw up hold me back from giving my gift as fully as I can, knowing that I'll have my, you know, that I won't do it perfectly and my limitations will be mirrored back to me and I will screw up, but that in doing that, the world will be furthered if I do it with sincerity.
Yeah, if there is a spiritual core, if there is a deep self, if there is an inner genius that knows who we are and what we are here to do, then that has to be trusted. And it has to be, in a sense, acted upon. And if I wait until the circumstances seem perfect, I've waited too long. If my concern is that I might make a mistake or do the wrong thing and therefore I don't act, well, now I have made a mistake and done the wrong thing. In other words, either we are tied to the soul of the world, which is going to pull us by the thread of our awakening, or we're not. And if we're not, then whoa, now I'm starting to feel despair. But if we are, in other words, let me give an example. So I've been working for over 3 decades, as you mentioned, with at-risk youth. You know, young people are supposed to receive a blessing that confirms their essential self as they try to find their way onto the road of life. And so I felt compelled to try and help with that. And then it turns out, so let's say you call that mentoring, because that was the old word for it, learning by engagement with someone who's trying to be helpful, let's say. So I found myself in these circumstances where young people are really desperate and asking for something, and I don't know if I have anything to offer, honestly speaking. And so, but I also couldn't not be present, because I remembered what it felt like to be desperate and longing and trying to find something of meaning in the world when I was young. So I have to meet them there. And so then a kind of amazing thing happened, which is I found out that a mentor doesn't have to know the answers. It's much more about showing up. And if you go back to the Odyssey, where the word mentor enters the world through the Homer's Odyssey, mentor is an old sailor who's walking on the beach and encounters Telemachus, who's the prince of the realm, who is lamenting because the realm has been taken over by marauders, whatever you want to call it, the Teapotty or whatever. You know, it happens all the time. And he's young, and he knows what should happen, but doesn't feel capable of it. And he's lamenting to the ocean that he's, you know, incapable of doing what he has to do, when up comes mentor. And so then in the Odyssey it says, when mentor speaks to the young prince lamenting the condition of the world, it is the goddess Athena who speaks through him. In other words, you don't have to go all the way and have all the knowledge. You have to show up in the place that you're called to. And then things that are unknown to oneself will appear, or will arrive through oneself. And so the real act of mentoring is being present with the awareness that I don't necessarily know, and the openness that knowledge could arise from inside me or from inside the mentee or from the goddess Athena, however you want to think about it. And that goes back to an old mythical idea, which we don't have to go all the way. We just have to go far enough. How do they say that? It's not just that people are thirsty and longing for the water, but it's also the water is longing for the people to drink. So the divine will meet us halfway if we find anything close to the right path and give it our full effort, which would include throwing our ego into the mix along with everything else we have. Then the divine comes to meet us. That's my understanding of how real work occurs.
That's really beautiful. Thank you so much. I know that there are often situations in which everybody's being polite enough. Everybody is being held within various conventions of behavior, so that this white fog makes it really hard for an authentic conversation to take place. And we kind of have to break through it. And I find that it feels like arrogance to presume that I'm better than anybody else. I see through the fog better than you. You need to listen to me. I kind of have to begin by turning to myself and maybe confessing my own challenge, so that I'm leading with, you know, if I'm asking for someone else's humility, I kind of have to lead with my own.
Yeah, kind of awkward.
I wonder what wisdom you've learned in the trenches about all of that.
Well, to me, it's paradoxical. Again, there's two sides to it. So I've done a lot of workshops trying to help people who want a mentor, right? Because, you know, mentoring is the old mammal way of transferring knowledge. So anyone interested in knowledge eventually has to become interested in transferring it. And mentoring, you know, guru to devotee, if you want to go that route, but it's really, you know, embodied person to embodied person. And so, you know, if I had to boil all the workshop stuff about mentoring down to one thing, I would say it's be authentic. Authenticity is the missing ingredient in all those conversations. And young people, you know, now have a heightened sense for the inauthentic because that's what's delivered to them all the time. And so if I am authentic, then I could be either in the place of going, wow, you know, I see the size of the problem and I feel both small and humble and a bit terrified. That would be an authentic way to enter a conversation or a situation. But another authentic way would be, I recognize the kind of over-polite agreement that's being made here so that people are dancing around the subject, and I think I will put some salt on the table. And so then maybe that's the move from mentoring to the elder. So, you know, the old idea of the elders was they brought salt. You know, like right now in America, the disparity has grown so huge that it is making the whole culture sick. And that needs to be shown more readily to people. But one of the things that elders used to do is bring the salt of that kind of knowledge. And one of the things that I wish more older people, so we have more older people now than any other group in the culture. But I'm waiting for the elders to become elders. Everybody gets older. But to become an elder is to awaken to the real situation that I'm in and what can I do with it. And so a little salt would be to say that right now, the fastest growing segment of the population suffering from poverty and even the lack of food are infants. And how can anyone sit in places of power and even in places of corporate wealth and pretend that they are carrying out the role of a genuine adult if they are withholding food and sustenance from infants? That would be the salt of the elders saying, we don't care how you got your money. We don't care what everybody thinks economics might mean. What we care about is that, you know, little ones being born are not being fed. And that is the first requirement of being an actual adult. And so sometimes the authentic thing is to bring my own fear and my own woundedness to the conversation, but it's just as authentic to bring a salt, which hopefully could awaken people to an ongoing damage that's not being dealt with.
Yeah, very.
You know, first problem is I don't fully show up. You know, and the second problem, in a sense, is I have the responsibility to bring something that cuts through the skin of politeness and the kind of subtle agreements people make in order to collectively avoid things.
Yes. Beautiful. Well, Michael, I have a few more questions I want to ask, but it's about the time for me to invite people to ask questions. So if you've dialed in on the phone, you can press *2 on your telephone keypad to raise your hand. Or if you're listening via computer, there's a window and you can type in questions and I can take a look at those and ask some of them. A couple of announcements first. To learn more about Michael Mead and his work, including the Genius Project, please go to the Mosaic website at mosaicvoices.org. That's MOSAICVOICES.org. Visit the online store to purchase copies of The Genius Myth, other books, CDs, and digital downloads. All the product purchases support Mosaic's Genius Project. The website also contains information about upcoming retreats. You can register for the annual fall retreat with Michael this September 22nd through 25th on the Olympic Peninsula. This year's theme is The Pathless Path, about stepping off the given path in order to learn where our inner spirit would have us go to contribute to the continuance of the world. To receive notices of upcoming events and publications, as well as his timely video commentary, please subscribe to Mosaic's email list at mosaicvoices.org. And then about my own work, my work is dedicated to human transformation on all scales, focusing on both the inner and the outer work. And you can find a rich body of blog posts, articles, audios and videos, events, and more, and connect with my mailing list at terrypatten, terrypatten.com. And I've got a in-person seminar at Esalen starting in just about a week from now in Orange County. I'll be at the Unity Church of Tustin towards the end of September. Later this year, I'll be in Mexico in October, and then in November in Boulder, Colorado at the Integral Living Room. So please join my mailing list and stay tuned at terrypatten.com. Now let me take a look and see what's happened here with questions, if anybody's raised their hand or typed in questions. Okay. You know, there are quite a few. An old friend of mine, Tom Phillips, asks, can you say more about the soul? Sometimes I've doubted the existence of my soul because it's so elusive, and yet at other times I distinctly feel it. How can I come to know my soul more fully?
That's a beautiful question. Of course, we doubt the existence of the soul. Western culture since the Enlightenment tells us that it doesn't exist. So one of the old ways of looking at it is the difference between spirit and soul, just to get soul into the conversation. Ultimately, spirit and soul are the same thing or manifestations of the same thing. But the old idea was that spirit is connected to air and fire and it ascends, and soul is connected to water and earth and it descends. So soul is like water. That's why it's elusive. It's flowing and changing all the time. It has many different states. Water can turn into ice, so on and so forth. Soul is also the huge sea that's holding the whole earth together, that kind of thing. It's also connected to the unconscious, often conceived as a big dark ocean. But then it has this earth side to it also, which is the solidity. Earth is that which really secretly, constantly, moment to moment, is unifying all the earthlings. We're all touching the earth in some sense, and we're connected that way even if we don't know it. And soul is the great connecting tissue of the world. And so that way we could feel it maybe as more present. So when a person extends, soul is the connecting element of life. And so when a person extends care towards another, they're actually growing soul a little bit. And so caring from oneself also grows the soul. And so I don't know if that helps, but that's the first move, is to connect soul to water, changeability, flow, a capacity to move from state to state, the real sustaining energy behind transformation. And then on the other hand, the source of care and connectedness. And you could say that in a time like this, when there's tremendous polarity and increasing opposition, what's really missing is soul. And so maybe a last thing about that, a soul is the connective energy of life. And so soul is what connects us to the point or the purpose of our life. And so any real arc of transformation requires soul, just the way water and earth are required to balance air and fire.
Beautiful. And clear. I love the use of the elements to make that distinction clearer. I have a follow-on question, though. Many of us, myself included, have dedicated a significant portion of our lives to spiritual work, you know, associated with air and fire and ascent. And understanding how to integrate that, very often people talk about soul as if it's a radical alternative to spirit. You know, like we need to do the soul work, not just the spirit work. Don't just ascend, descend, do the... And somehow I feel like this either-or isn't it, that there's something true about the spirit work and that can maybe even empower and enliven and illuminate the soul work. And I wonder how you see that.
Well, in a sense, I see it a number of ways. In a sense, spirit and soul are trying to make love, and they can only do it through us. That would be the quickest way to get there. And then I like the last Western attempt, in a sense, at mysticism was alchemy. And in alchemy, they have what they call circulatio, which means that we're constantly being pulled into a circle of spiritual, emotional, soulful growth. And at times that pull pulls us into the realm of spirit, and we're supposed to drink that that realm in as much as possible, inhale it, absorb it, you know, dedicate ourselves to it. But then it's a natural part of the cycle that pulls us into the depths and kind of a dynamic balance with that spirit occurs through soulfulness. And go back to the bodhisattva idea. If I really become spiritually awake, what do I do with that awakeness? And in that sense, I bring it to the world. I use it as a gift or a giving back to the world. So the danger is usually of spirit is disembodiment. And the other way to look at it is the individual rises on the wings of spirit, but the individual to sustain spiritual awareness usually needs some connection to community, and community benefits from the connection to the individual who's awake. So I don't know. We easily can get caught in an argument between spirit and soul, but that's why I started by saying there are two manifestations of the same thing. It's like the old argument between the one and the many. Is there one universal divine? Pretty much, yeah, I'd say. Does it manifest as multiple? It seems to. That's the only way you can see it. And that's the difference between spirit and soul, the oneness and the multiplicity of soul are both part of what we live and who we are in our essence.
Yeah, beautiful. You know, a number of people have written in very vivid, very vulnerable, very human communications, and I'd like to give you a chance to respond to the soul qualities in these. There's not always a clear question, but I'd like to read a series of these if you're willing. One of them really touches me from Sue. She doesn't say where she's from. Being single, living alone, not having love in my life except from my pets, I feel even more rattled by what's going on in the world and don't have anyone to talk about it with, to pour my heart out to. Therapists aren't the same as having a loved one close to you. Sorry, I feel like I'll go crazy. I need love and closeness and someone who truly cares about me to feel sane and happy. In the absence of that, how can I feel better, more secure in this insane world we live in? Help.
Yeah, that's the despair I was talking about. It's right under the skin of everything that's happening. And so a person has to take risk, and the risk has to be reaching out. But more to the point, perhaps, she mentions the pets, and that could be a real place to begin. That's currently her connection. The world of nature, the world of animals are also companions on this very uncertain journey. And so maybe if she followed that a little bit, it could lead to someone else who has that affection for pets. But one way or the other, the biggest mistake is to practice an isolation that isn't generative to life. So there has to be a way to risk connection, and I think there's real both intelligence and strength in the fact that she knows she needs love, and love is not the same as therapy. So I just hope she can find a way and risk that somehow she can make it across that bridge and find, and I couldn't agree with her more. We all need, Jung called it friends of the deep self, friends who know us well and we know them well enough that we can say exactly what's on our soul. So I really wish her our luck in finding that. And there has to be, usually the reason we can't find someone to talk with and be with is because we're still carrying a wound. Often it goes all the way back to infantile abandonment, and we have to find a way to cross that abandoned territory and find someone to connect to. I hope she can do that.
Mm. Yeah. We have to risk re-experiencing the rejection or abandonment in order to find our way into contact with others. Yeah.
As an infant, it felt like it was annihilating. As an adult, we can realize it's not.
Yeah. Nirmala in Mexico is a very different voice. Says, human beings are not in control. We've lived in egocentric and materialistic ways that creation now is no longer going to support. We need to find solutions on how to survive the collapsing of the pillars that have sustained us, what to do with the little money we have, how to survive on little or no food. Are we, the ones who still have a little, going to be prepared to share that with the people that are our neighbors? Words, ideas, intellectual conversations are not going to solve anything. We are filled with fear and worry. The majority of people are not into philosophy, meditation, spirituality. The earth is going to be okay, us human beings not. And so ends another civilization because it could not overcome greed, laziness, and selfishness. I've heard many voices say something that expresses this sort of voice that I'm hearing from Nirmala here, and I'd love to hear how you address the...
So two of the big, you know, there's big dangers in the world right now in terms of free-floating fear and anxiety, right? Anxiety is a normal condition if you're facing a test or something, but now you have collective anxiety that you don't even know why it's there. So those things are happening. But the two other things that I noticed that can be very detrimental to the growth of the spirit and the soul are cynicism and nihilism. And so it's very easy to become cynical, and then it's very easy to be pulled towards nihilism. So nihilism means it all amounts to nothing, and particularly that the human presence in the cosmos amounts to nothing. And I really want to stand against that. I cannot go there because I work with young people, because life intends to continue, and humans are essential to life. Yes, we're not in charge of it. That was the big mistake of the Enlightenment, and it's a mistake that's been made before. But then it's another mistake to say because we're not in charge of it, we don't count. Another mistake. Humans are in this paradoxical position. We've already kind of talked about it a little bit. On one level, we are a speck in an uncountable, you know, ongoing cosmos. On another level, as above, so below. That which exists in the great cosmos exists in the microcosmos. And inside the soul of each person is something that is secretly tied to creation. Were that to be awake, we can be yet maybe small in some way, or I don't know how, but ongoing agents of creation. If well-intentioned people do not feel part of creation ongoing, then they are by default contributing to the collapse that everyone's afraid of. I really think that, yes, it's easy to fall into delusions of grandeur, and it's really easy to fall into delusions of nihilism. When a person is in touch with the depth of their own soul and their authentic being, that is not a problem. They will feel humble, even standing next to a tree, but they will feel creative in ways that are meaningful in their life. I don't think we can risk nihilistic experiments.
Beautiful. Well, I want to ask a question that I didn't get a chance to ask before the break that is important to ask you before we're done, which is I find that I continually need to open to new challenges. Whatever I'm able to do is leading somewhere, you know, to a new and a previously unseen level of authenticity or moral courage or heroism or humility or capacity to listen or something. And at every point along the journey, there's some new level ahead of me that I haven't gotten to. And so that next level lies on the far side of a transformative, you know, a death and rebirth, a transformation. So I imagine that you have been taken apart and put back together by your process of growth again and again. And if you'd be willing, I'd be grateful if you'd share what the questions are or what the processes are that are challenging you right now and transforming you. How the next process of your own dissolution and reintegration looks like and feels like to you.
Well, that's a pertinent question. So I think I would put it this way. My basic position relative to the culture has been as an outsider. Not joining groups, you know, because I'm questioning things or I'm being pulled in some way that feels more compelling or whatever the reason might be. Being highly critical of the culture that I live in. Working the fields of doubt a lot. Mm. And then coming to a point in life, well, let me add one other thing. Deeply intrigued with esoteric understandings and you know, just saying the perfect day for me is have nothing planned so I can get up and pick up a thread of mythology and follow it, you know, until I absolutely run out of energy. That's, you know, like a fine day. And, if I can step outside and then, you know, somehow share that with the trees or something. So, and then getting to be older, you know, an older, you know, kind of person and really realizing the condition of the world and the kind of instinctive responsibility to try and contribute something or help somehow. And so, and then saying, okay, I think and feel and imagine my way through these issues of mythology and personal growth and all the time. And more typical for me is to go, if someone doesn't get it, okay, there's many other ways to get things. Go get it, you know, or ignore it. And feeling a different feeling now, which is if there's a way that mythological imagination can be helpful, I feel much more compelled to find ways to deliver it or to, you know, to put it out or put it in somewhere. And that goes very much against my outsider inclinations. And I'm using outsider both as a, you know, kind of a social idea, but also in the old Vedic idea of being outside the mainstream and being okay with that. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's what it makes me think and feel. A greater compulsion or instinct to try and give something that I know is in its essence esoteric to the exoteric world in case it could be helpful.
Does that mean in a way that you're more willing to endure the discomfort and the pain of the non-comprehension and resistance in others?
Yes, and even the rejection. So you know, I once turned down, you know, I won't name the programs, but major, you know, network programs. I said I would come on, you know, that kind of expansive TV thing and suffer that exposure. If it's an issue of war or peace, if it's an issue of social justice, or if it's an issue of, you know, oppression and young people or something, I gave them three things, and that's not what they wanted. So I never did it, and it didn't matter that much. And I noticed now that I would accept the invitation regardless of what the theme was, and I would turn the theme into what I think is important, and that's a shift in my psyche.
Uh-huh. And in a way, though, you've been confirmed because you're feeling more confident that what it is that you're bringing is of real use to people, and that you
because the circumstances have finally gotten bad enough that people look into areas that they have formally rejected. But I think what I'm trying to answer, and maybe it's not coming fully across, is, you know, I don't lack ambition, but I know something about being exposed. And so when a person takes, and you were alluding to it, when a person takes a personal stance in an exposed way in the world now, you're exposed just the way we are exposed to the sun, because the filters that would protect us from the sun are not there anymore, and there's holes in the ozone. So standing outside, we're literally more exposed and more in danger from our own sun.
Yeah.
Well, in the public sphere, to stand in public in that light is also a greater exposure because of the conditions of the world, the lack of filters. And so people are, and you see it with politics now, it's not that, oh, I like this one better than that one. I like this one, and the other one's evil. And so
right.
That intensification of judgment and the intensification of the way people reject things is something that, you know, that is the greater exposure right now. And so I'm trying to be honest about the answer, and it's an odd thing because, for me it's odd even to talk about it, but I feel a requirement to take more chances in being exposed, knowing that that can involve rejection and other kinds of things, on the chance that it might help, you know, move things towards more coherence.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, there are several other questions that I wanted to presence. There's a plaintiff voice from France, people in New York, a woman we responded to. Oh, she asks, do you offer private sessions, Michael? She asks.
No,
that.
I do not. My friends won't let me. No, that's a joke. But I tend to be better with groups because I'm really instinctively intrigued with the uniqueness of the individual and the relationship of that uniqueness to the group. And so I think that tends to make me more effective with groups, I think.
Right.
Now, on a mentoring basis, it's one-on-one, but I don't do that professionally. I do that based on being in a project that brings everybody, you know, onto the edge of awakening, and then trying to mentor in those conditions. That seems, that for me works
mm-hmm.
better.
Mm-hmm. I see you're asking. You know, Sue, I do some private sessions with people. I'm not taking anybody here until after August, but I you know, I would be willing to consider working with people after that. Mary Linda asks the last question I'll have time to ask you, Michael. She asks, can it be possible that some genius is expressing the need to be patient, that this old paradigm needs to self-destruct? Many of us feel our genius is about the new creation, and our souls now awakened know as hard and heartbreaking as this waiting is, that it's equally important to hold something in the stillness as those who are rushing to take action now. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, totally. I'm not recommending rushing to take action. I'm saying move to the genius. And if the genius can be a very patient, it can be about stillness. Also empathy. Some people have the genius of empathy. Everybody has some dose of empathy, but some people have it in a genius dose. And so I'm not arguing for heroism. I'm distinctly not doing that, saying multiplicity is the answer. But in terms of the collective, I think, and I like patience. I'm not very patient, but I like it. But I'm thinking something like in the Renaissance, they used to say, festina lente, make haste slowly. And this goes back to your idea about the white fog or something, that, so there's two things going on at the same time. One, let's say we take the environment and the rate at which the ice caps are melting and all that, the urgency of doing something, being involved somehow. But once you get involved with nature, you can't move fast. You have to move in natural ways. And so the tension of being alive now is includes urgency and patience. That's how I would go at it. And then that old saying I like, festina lente, make haste slowly. Understand the urgency that calls to me, and then realize that within that urgency, I have to be patient and still be in tune with nature's way of unfolding. And if I don't know how to find the still waters, I'm not going to be very helpful.
Beautiful. Festina lente.
Lente. Yeah.
Those are great words for us to finish with. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Thank you so much, Michael.
Yeah, thank you, Terry.
This has been very, very rich. If you feel touched by what Michael has had to say today, please go to mosaicvoices.com and get and read his book, The Genius Myth. And if you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. We will post the recording of this conversation within a few days, and we will be sending out an email with a kind of little commentary about it. Thank you so much for joining Michael and me today, and goodbye, everybody. Deep bow, Michael. It's been a rich conversation.
A bow back to you and to everyone. Good luck in the world.